All right, tonight we're doing Parshas Devarim and Dr. Martin Luther King's Last Night. I'm going to share with you, actually, I listened today, I had an opportunity to listen to the entire 45-minute speech. They don't have the video of it, lost in the winds of time. We have a video of some of the two, three minutes of his last part of his speech, but the power of the speech and some of the things which are going to be rather instructive for us to appreciate the parsha of the week is captured. So that's it. So without further ado, this is just to give you the background, and it's very timely. This is the background. This takes us back to April 3rd, 1968, at the Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee. The 45-minute speech, which I'm not sharing with you tonight, deals with there was a sanitation worker strike, and the sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee, were nearly all black, and he was dealing with the issue of how to deal with that. But the last part, the last 2 minutes, is what I'm concerned about, and tragically, as we'll see. On April 4th in Memphis, Tennessee, Dr. King was assassinated. Okay, so here we go.
Hey, Rabbi Penny.
Hey, Jade, how are you? Good to see you.
Hey, how are you? Could we dedicate this class in merit of my father's work site?
100%.
The first of Av, along with Aaron HaKohen as well.
That's right. What's your father's name?
Beryl Ben Heschel.
Beryl Ben Heschel. This is Zecher Nishmas Beryl Ben Heschel, who obviously did a good job because he produced Jade. I already know he's ahead of the game. I already know he's ahead of the game. And then that itself is the essential zechus of him, and certainly that he's has a daughter who learns Torah on a Tuesday night and a Wednesday night and plenty more.
All right,
you 100%. Without further ado, we now present Dr. Okay.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. Totalitarian country. Maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech, somewhere I read. Of the freedom of press, somewhere I read. That the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. So just as I say, we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around. We aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
This is a CBS News special report.
Dan Rather reporting for CBS News from New York. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was shot to death by an assassin late today as he stood on a balcony in Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. King had planned to lead another civil rights march in Memphis next Monday. We got the latest on the story now from Russ Hodge, News Director of WREC-TV.
All right. All right, that clip always gives me chills. Okay, so let's just go over that. Okay. Okay. All right. So, okay, let's get into it. Okay, so what term best captures the Been to the Mountaintop speech? Is it a sermon? Is it an inspirational speech? Is it a harsh rebuke? Obviously, in a certain sense, it's all three. But what is it? What captures it? What would you say captures it more strikingly?
Inspirational?
He's,
you know, he's firing up the crowd. He's telling them, like, all the things that they can do and all the things that they will do and where it's going to take them. And it's getting them all, you know, excited.
Right. I mean, not only is it inspirational to them back in April 1968, here we are 52 years later. I think most people... even if you're not a black person, if you're a white middle-class person living on Long Island, like I am, you still feel inspired by that. This, first of all, just to know people who judge and rate these things. This is...
We're in the Ring Central meeting now.
Okay, great. The point being that this is one of rated as one of the top speeches given in the 20th century. Okay, number one. But what was amazing about all this, and one of the greatness of Martin Luther King, is that he is giving rather serious. The Hebrew word is musar. The English word is critique against the United States. What is the one of the top? What is the essential criticism that he's laying down against the United States?
That we have not lived up to the ideals. We have ideals. We have laws. We have Constitution, Bill of Rights, all those kind of things that have not been fully realized. He said, if we were in another country like a China or Russia that's totalitarian. They don't know those rights. They don't have them. We have them here, and yet we were not implementing them for all of our people in this country. So it was kind of the disappointment and rebuke for the failures for not getting there.
So let's go. What Marvin is saying is correct. So what, in essence, is he, by pointing his finger at the United States, what is he essentially claiming the United States is, in one word? Well, a couple of things, but from the direction that Marvin is saying,
they're wrong.
They're not just yes, they are correct. They are wrong, but there's something more deeper, more cutting.
Like failure.
Well, and obviously they're a failure, and obviously they're really, he's claiming they're racist. He calls them racist earlier in the speech, but he's making a powerful argument. Who can capture this? His
unequal,
yeah.
Well, right, because you are. So yeah. What do you call somebody who gives certain rights to some people, and not rights to other people? Yet you claim that everybody has the same rights. What do you?
Privilege.
Well, that's what the people, that's what the white people have. But what would you call such a person who claims to be sharing things equally and in fact are not? It's one...
A hypocrite.
Thank you, Chaim. Thank you. Thank you, Sarah Lewison. Welcome aboard. Yes. He's saying, as Marvin pointed out, if the United States was like Russia and in China, those are totalitarian states. They don't provide freedom of religion. They don't provide freedom of press. They don't provide freedom of assembly. They don't provide the right to protest full right. But we claim. What does it say in the Declaration of Independence? What's the biggest kasha?
I think all people have unalienable rights.
That the Creator has given unalienable rights to everybody. Yeah, that's if you have what he says. Yeah, you claim that on paper. You claim that on paper, but that don't happen to really apply if you are what? White. But if you are black or brown, that is not true. So, in a certain sense...
Or gay or lesbian or any other...
Right, but in 1968, that was... That issue was not yet another civil rights issue. That was actually a year before the start of the gay rights movement in Stonewall in Manhattan, a year later. But going back to this topic, so he has one major criticism. He says, you, America, claim that all of its citizens have unalienable rights. And those rights are what? Freedom of press, and freedom of assembly, and freedom of religion, and freedom to protest, right? And lo and behold, but if you have, that really happens to be, in fact, if you are white. If you are not white, you seem to have a lot less, or none of those rights. Here's the question: when you're hearing his speech, everybody said, as Scott said, and I think he's on point, that you hear that speech, you feel inspired by the speech. You do not feel that he's criticizing. How did he do that? He's laying down some of the harshest critique to 85% of the United States, i.e., at that point, white America. How did he pull that off?
I'll tell you, Rabbi.
Yes.
I think he was able to do it because he was focusing on the result of what he wanted to get out of the speech. And instead of working on the critique, if you're looking at the end result, how are you going to get there? Right? You can be bitter or put everybody down, or you can choose to take a higher road and inspire and focus on the outcome, where you want to get it.
So Chaim is, again, second point. I don't know what he had for breakfast, but he's on point.
It was my last meat dinner.
That's it. You're feeling jazzed. All right, good. So as Chaim pointed out.
It happens to be, I just had an issue with this. I actually had a personal issue, and I had to make a choice of how I was going to try to get it right. I could have been complaining or critical or criticizing or feeling left out and being a little person, or I could make myself big and be like so grateful for everything they do for me and why they're a great company and why they're a great organization, and then why I want to do this and add more, and maybe you guys can help me support about it. And they embraced it. I can tell you the story another time. Anyway.
Okay, so just to unpack what Chaim pointed out about Martin Luther King is that he is sharing... not the oppression, not that the black people do not have freedom of press, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, freedom to protest. He's talking about, I see the promised land. As he says, I've been to the mountaintop. Now, don't forget, Martin Luther King is a Christian minister. An ordained Christian minister. What? Because this is going to be a major point. What is the first thing he did? As far as his rhetorical device, what did he do by saying, "I've been to the mountaintop and I see the promised land. I may not get there with you." What is he essentially identifying himself as?
Well,
Moshe.
He's Moshe. Moshe, who was leading his people out of slavery. In other words, one of the major motifs of the thought and speeches of Martin Luther King was, yes, Abraham Lincoln in 1863 signed the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing all the slaves. But like he said, but like giving a per by opening the door to the cell and giving the person no land, no money, no education, you're de facto essentially leaving him in a slave-like state. So he is there to push Black America and White America toward a true freeing of the slave and to bring them to the promised land. What, of course, is eerie about his thing when he says, "I may not get there, and I'm not afraid, and I'm afraid of no man." Correct.
I don't know if that's eerie. I think he's being realistic of, you know, he might have to take a bullet for the cause.
But it's eerie because literally under 24 hours later, he in fact was assassinated at his hotel. And he was saying he knew...
He knew what he was getting into. People were getting killed up to right every year beforehand or beaten. So come out there,
right.
He's a target.
Correct. In other words, he knew that, in other words, it was in direct measurement of his effectiveness of bringing the case to America, of basically showing America, you're a hypocrite, but doing it in the way that's not offensive. He was able to give a musser, to give a criticism, which is extremely deep. He's basically saying, You're basically Rishayim. You're running a racist state, and you claim to be tzaddikim. I mean, that's what he's... I'm just putting it in different words. If he would have said that, he would have been ignored. But he's able to express it in a way that both, of course, Black America and even many segments of White America in the late 60s was able to really hear it. Now, of course... He's gifted. Now he nearly never looks at it is at a paper. He's talking to you, and his cadence, and his imagery, and there's never an and an. His delivery is impeccable, and again he's speaking to a Baptist audience, so it has the sort of sing song interaction of a Baptist minister. Sermon. So this guy was unbelievable. So he focused. So let's talk about other strategies. Number one, he focused on the solution. Number two, he's able to, in tremendous eloquence, talk about the problem. He doesn't say what. Who could? I'll give you. There's many examples. How did he point the finger? Did he? To America. He did it in such an ingenious way. I don't know if it was conscious or unconscious. Okay. Could anybody tell me in his speech, how did he do it, which is a classic way if you ever have to give criticism to any person, a colleague, a friend, a relative, an employee, he did something very subtle. Who can tell me?
You know, it's criticism in between compliments.
All right, criticism within compliments. In other words, he's saying, America's a great country. He didn't say America's evil. And also, he pointed, his criticism was indirect. As he says, somewhere I heard about the freedom of religion. Somewhere I heard the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I heard about the right to protest for right. In other words, by using the somewhere I heard, he's not pointing the finger directly, squarely at the United States government and the United States and the American people. Somewhere I heard. Okay? even though it's a little bit, it's obvious if you deconstruct it like we're doing now, what he accomplished, but emotionally, you don't feel criticized. As a white person listening to the speech, you don't feel, you're not feeling bad, you're feeling motivated. You're feeling sympathetic toward his cause. Also, he's sharing the altruism. They're going to come at us with dogs and with water, but I, you know, we don't care. We're not going to do any violent. He learned from Gandhi. Just for those who don't, if you studied Martin Luther King, he was a student of Gandhi about the power of nonviolent protest. So he was not going to burn down the place. Unfortunately, there were protests where there were, you know, violence. Of course, this happened after he died, where it was just simply a, there were people that argued. Who was the famous black leader who argued with Martin Luther King as a different way to create social change?
Malcolm X.
All right, good. I'm making sure you guys are awake up there. Okay, good. Malcolm X, because he felt that Martin Luther King's approach intention was too weak and not going to be effective. So, all right, that's a little bit of American civil rights history. Okay, now we're going to take what Martin Luther King did, and we're going to see what the opening. We're getting to the Book of Devarim, just to give you the context. In this case, Moshe is going to die, and everybody knows it. In other words, he's not going to be assassinated, but basically, Moshe has a job of sharing his sort of last speech with the people. It's basically going to be about 6 or 7 weeks. He's going to talk to them, sort of the final words, let's call it the final lectures, the final shiurim, and they know it. They know it. He told them. We talked about a couple weeks ago. A new leader is already appointed. His name is Yehoshua. Everybody's ready. So he gets up to the lectern to share his last words and testament to the Jewish people. And that is the book of Devarim. Okay? So that's really Moshe Rabbeinu. These are his words. And Moshe and God said that this is going to be part of the Torah, validated this as being is correct, and made it and told Moshe to at the end to write this all down, or write excerpts of the speeches for posterity's sake, thus making up the Book of Devarim. So without further ado, let's get into actually reading. Do you guys see the Devarim?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So let me have... All right, so Marvin, start us out. First...
These are the words that Moses spoke to all Israel on the east bank of the Jordan, in the desert, and in the Arabah, near this, in the vicinity of Paran, Shofel, Levan, Hazeroth, and Dizahav. This is in the area which is an 11-day journey from Horeb to Kadesh, Barnea, by way of the Seir Highlands. On the first of the 11th month in the 40th year, Moses also spoke to the Israelites regarding all that God had commanded him for them. This was after he had defeated Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, who lived in Asroth, who was defeated in Edrei. Moses began to explain the law on the east bank of the Jordan in the land of Moab, saying...
Okay, so let's take a look at the very first verse. What is weird in the very first pasuk? So he says, these are the words that Moses spoke to all on the east bank of the Jordan. We should have a period right there. Then it says, in the desert and in the Arabah, near Suf, in the vicinity of Paran, Tophel, Lavan, Chatzerot, and Dizahav. What is challenging about the pasuk?
Is Arvah the east bank of the Jordan?
Well, these places seem not to be in the same place. So he's saying they're in the east bank of the Jordan and in the desert and in the Arava near Suf, Paran, Tophel, Lavan. These seem to be other places that they had once been. So how, if you're going to give a GPS location of where he did the lecture, the shir, the speech, why is he mentioning all these things? So the way that Rashi, which we're about to read, learns this pasuk is not that he spoke to them in the east bank of the Jordan, and the key word is concerning, the implied word is concerning the desert, the Arava, the Suf, Paran, Tophel, Lavan, Chatzor, and Dizahav. Now, what's going on there? So let's go to Rashi, who's going to unpack that. Let me have Suzanne, Bavakasha.
These are the words. Since these are words of rebuke, and he, Moses, enumerates, here are all the places where they anger the omnipresent. Therefore, it makes no explicit mention of the incidents in which they transgressed, but rather merely alludes to them by mentioning the names of the places out of respect for Israel.
Okay. So he starts off his speech, and we're going to talk about these places. Okay? All right, we're going to get to that. Now, next, we'll hold that Rashi in your back pocket. We're going to circle back to that. Let's do it the next Rashi. We're gonna do three Rashis. All right. Who any volunteers to do the next Rashi to all of Israel?
I'll try it.
Good, Scott, you can do it.
To all of Israel, if he had rebuked only some of them, those who were in the marketplace, i.e., absent, might have said, "Who heard from Moses, son of Aram, and did not answer a single word regarding this and that?" Had we been there, we would have answered him. Therefore, he assembled all of them and said to them, "See, you are all here. If anyone has an answer, let him answer."
Okay, so he purposely provided, this was a speech given to the entire Jewish people. Okay, so purposely, because he wanted to avoid that if he gave it to only a select few. According to the Midrash here, if I was there, I would have, if he's going to come criticize us, I would have answered him back. So he brought, for the 5 weeks of the speeches, this was done with everybody. Okay? Let's do the next Rashi. All right, who wants to do the next one?
I'll take it.
All right, Shannon, take it.
And it came to pass in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first of the month, Moshe spoke. This teaches us that he rebuked them only a short while before his death. From whom did he learn to do this? From Yaakov, who rebuked his sons only a short while before his death. He said, "Reuven, my son, I will tell you why I have not reproved you for your shortcomings during all these years, that you would not leave me and join my brother Esau. And for four reasons, one should not reprimand a person except shortly before one's death, so that one should not rebuke and again have to rebuke him, so as not to cause his friend to feel ashamed when he sees him," etc. These appear in Sifrei. And similarly, Yehoshua rebuked Israel only shortly before his death. And so Shmuel, as it is said, "Behold, testify against me." And so also David rebuked his son Shlomo only shortly before his death.
Okay. So, in other words, Moshe for a long time had certain conversations that he wanted to have with the Jewish people. But he waited to the last 5 weeks before he passed away. Why was that? What is Rashi's basic answer?
Sounds like he may have zipped out of there. It's like going Esau.
Well, that was Yaakov. That's why Yaakov did that. Yaakov did not share his displeasure about Reuven's behavior until the end of his life, because he was afraid that what would occur. Well, what was his fear about the rebuke?
It would lead to him taking off.
Right, he can't always. His eldest son can't handle it. He'll feel embarrassed or ashamed, and basically, he would go and join forces with Yaakov's brother, who had, you know, had a growing society. Okay, so basically, we already see that Rashi already gives us 2 points. We're going to go analyze this momentarily. Two strategies that Moshe was avoiding giving these words of rebuke, which are woven in through the next series of Parshiot. He waited now because he did not want for the rebuke to go bad. So let's take it step by step. In what sense is Moshe similar to MLK?
He's telling people that, you know, there's this place, you know, Jerusalem, this place Israel, you know, I might not get there, but you're going to get there.
All right, but what in for both Moshe and MLK, what is the land? What is the promised land really? Is it only a geographical point on a globe? What does it represent to both MLK and to Moshe?
Freedom.
Not only freedom.
Equal rights, like they're as good as the Egyptians. You know what I mean? Like they could do all the stuff that the Egyptians were able to do.
Right, a place where all were values of justice and equality and charity and kindness. In other words, all the biblical values which Martin Luther King was espousing and saying that America is not stepping up to its responsibilities, right? So he said, I can see it there. I can see it. In other words, basically, what was he saying? I can see the promised land, but I might not get there with you. Construct his metaphor. What was he really saying in April 1968?
This may not happen in my lifetime.
But what positive thing is he saying? What is he asserting? I can see the promised land. What does that mean? What does he mean that I can see the promised land?
That they're close to it. The seeds for this land of freedom have already been planted and things are working in motion.
Exactly. In other words, it was by 1968, 1968 was not 1964. Already, he felt, and I think he was right, that the civil rights movement was effectuating a change which would make an impact. Now, of course, the debate that we're having today in America is, has Martin Luther King's promised land dream of America happened? Is it not? Or where are we? Are we in the promised land? Are we still on the mountain? You know, that, of course, is a grand debate with Black Lives Matter and the issues of white privilege, pro and against, all these different issues. That really, you could really singularly reduce the debate is, where are we on the journey? Have we arrived at the promised land? And these, and the people who are claiming not are exaggerating what the reality. But really, we are in a country which is fundamentally disposed of racism. Or fundamentally, we're closer to where Martin Luther King was in 1968. That is the debate, the grand debate that is being fought over in America. Moshe is going to talk to them also about, we're going to go into the land, and he's going to talk about, and he's talking about a glorious future. But he's going to talk about things that they need to do in order to get there. In other words, both of them are sharing criticism about things they need to overcome, as the phrase, we shall overcome. There are things that the Black America has to overcome and white America has to overcome before there is a promised land. And Moshe Rabbeinu is going to share in the next series of Parshiot things that the Jewish people have to overcome. in order to get to the promised land. In other words, he's not letting them in yet. You know what I'm saying? But, in other words, they were only a couple miles away. Those who were on the fellowship trip, we went to Mitzpeh Yericho. You could see from, you could see the entire Jordan Valley. You see the slender Jordan River. Across the way, you see the Arve Moav, the Moabite, you see the mountain range, which is where Moshe looked over, Har Nevo. We pointed that out, Rabbi Liebtag did. And then behind those mountains where this speech is happening. So it's not that far away, but he's not going to let them in, not allow Yeshua to let them in until they have learned about what they need to do to get in there. Okay. So what challenges does Moshe have as expressed through these Rashis, which we pointed out that MLK also had, that he has to overcome? What does Moshe have to overcome to deliver the goods? What, in order for him to be effective in the Musar, what does he have, into the rebuke, what does he have to overcome? And in general, for anybody about hearing criticism, imagine you're an employer and you have to give a mixed review of an employee. Are you feeling nervous about delivering that? You should be, because it can go bad real quick. It's not. Is that easy to give criticism? Is that an easy job? I'm getting a head shake from Shana, okay? It's very hard. Right, have you found that people are open to constructive criticism?
No.
Why not?
Nobody likes to be criticized.
Why?
They take it personally.
Why?
Because it's...
I think people have a difficult time separating the behaviors from the person, so they immediately, like, internalize it, and it take it as part of who they are, rather than it's a behavior. It's not who they are. It's difficult for people to take that in, if that makes sense.
You are, Suzanne is 100% correct. In other words, let's use the most simple example. Let's say you have an employee who is chronically late to work. Every business has the chronic late guy or gal. Okay, not going to pick on only guys. All right? And if you have the unfortunate job, you work for HR, you are the supervisor, and you got to sit down with this person and talk to them about their chronic tardiness, what the challenge you have to overcome is that immediately they're going to hear in your words that you're saying that they're a bad person. And that's why they're late, because they're a bad person. So there's a whole art form that that you can learn and not to be able to effectively separate just criticizing the behavior while maintaining the sense of personal dignity in the person. Now, Rashi shares, how hard is that to do that? What's Rashi's proof? Rashi brings four biblical characters to make one essential assertion, which is what?
Rashi's saying it's difficult to do and that people aren't going to listen, and we see that by people not giving this criticism until they're on their deathbed and can no longer give the criticism after that point.
So we're going to skip to question number 8, and I'll go back to the other ones. How is the fact that Moshe would soon die helpful for the Jewish people's ability to truly hear, accept, and integrate his Musar? They know he's going to be dead in 5 weeks. Roughly 5 weeks. They don't know the exact, whatever. That's what it's going to be. Why is that helpful?
They know it's their last chance to hear from their great teacher and leader.
But one second, but how do you avoid their Suzanne problem? If you criticize somebody and it's harsh criticism, they're going to take it personally, they're going to shut down, they're going to get angry, or like in case of Yaakov's fear that Reuven, that he would actually just leave, you know what I mean? Slam the door and run out, right? How do they, how is Yaakov and Moshe and Shmuel and David being on their near deathbed overcome that objection? How does the near-death situation solve the problem in delivering of Mussar?
Well, people will be more, if they know somebody's going to pass away, they're not going to be as nasty back to them. You may be, if you feel that you can get control of the situation and tell them off. You don't want to tell off somebody who's just about to die and has, you know, that coming up. And you know that other people are going to be more sympathetic towards that person, more inclined to listen to that person. Rather than let's have a revolt again, you know, we've had a couple of those revolt type situations along the way.
Now, so I want to press you more, Marvin. What you're saying is 100% correct, but why are in addition to because they're going to, why are they more able to hear? Why are they going to be more sympathetic to Moshe's words? We can go a little deeper, which is the same reason why people are not sympathetic when. That it's not a near-death situation.
I'll go back to what you said before. Unless you want just Marvin to answer.
No.
Go ahead, Chaim. Ahead.
No, it's what you said before. Back to what you said before. The personal aspect is not there, and the person is just looking at you coming from a place of a love and meaning for them as, you know, not personal at all. So it's not a, they can take less personal. And there's also maybe the stigma of that last dying wish. People listen to people more when they're at their deathbed, but that's not the case with Martin Luther King. That's the case in Mussar.
Right,
like, but looking out for the future again, looking out for you for your next day, which I'm not going to be around to. So it has nothing to do with me. It's just you.
Exactly. Well, what Chaim said. That's exactly the point. That's a very important. In other words, if and this is the key element for delivering constructive criticism for your children, to your friends, to your family, they have to feel. That what you're sharing to them is 100% in the other person's best interest, and it's not coming from your own agenda. When a person's, when they know that Moshe has days, weeks, if not all days to live, they know it's not about him. There's no agenda. He's leaving. Moshe's going to be stepping off the covenantal stage, and it's game over. So what he's telling you is 100% the MS, and it's only for your benefit, and it's only for you to grow as a person. Okay, even with that, what did Rashi say? He started off the speech just by alluding. We're going to talk about a couple subjects. He doesn't go right into it. Okay. In fact, he's going to go into it via stories in the same way that MLK did. He talks about, I'm on the mountaintop, talk about the promised land, talk about the Jews being freed from Pharaoh. He's using the biblical imagery, okay? So, too, Moshe Rabbeinu is not going to say, you guys are a bunch of bums, and let me tell you your defects. He doesn't say that. He starts off very chill. First of all, he waits till whether they're going to be open to hear what he has to say. That's number one. Number two. He talks about, he just mentioned, we're going to talk about a few topics. Doesn't go into them yet. He warms them up a little bit. In other words, it's more toward an inspiring speech, as Scott pointed out, not a speech of rebuke, of nasty rebuke. Okay? Okay, that's number two. Next, how does the fact that they were coming off two huge military successes, the destruction of Sichon and Og, which Marvin read about, they're coming off, they had conquered the entire, what we call nowadays, the Golan Heights, okay? The Golan Heights and a chunk of northern Jordan, modern-day Jordan. How do you think they're feeling, and why is Moshe saying this is a good time to talk to them?
Feeling pretty good.
Great.
It's a good time to, like, talk to them when their spirits are high.
Right, when you're feeling like a winner, when you're feeling like you're rich, when you're feeling like you're successful, you're in a much more positive and open-minded perspective. And your sense of self, as Susano says, the issue is the ego. Right now, how is their ego? Healthy or not healthy?
Healthy. Healthy,
strong, confident. You know, they're doing great. They're feeling awesome. They're rocking it. So Moshe, in an indirect kind of way, in a poetic kind of way, in a story form kind of way, in a soft kind of way, in a dramatic kind of way, all these things put together, he's going to share a few stories. I need to talk about, before we go in, I got to talk about a few things. So now, he's getting them when they're going to be the most open. Okay? And here's a key question. We're going to get to, and there's a take. What inheritance was Moshe trying to leave the Jewish people right now? We don't think about inheritance in this way. What inheritance is Moshe leaving to the Jewish people?
Knowledge.
What kind of knowledge?
Knowledge of self.
Knowledge of self, self-knowledge. In particular, what kind of self, what areas of self-knowledge?
Wisdom.
All knowledge is, I mean, wisdom. Wisdom, self-knowledge, but in what areas?
Faith.
No. He's going to talk about faith as well, but there's this particular knowledge and insight, self-knowledge. He's going to give them insight about their Achilles heel, their weaknesses. Where do they fall short? Where are their trouble spots? Where has the Jewish people gotten hard? And truthfully, he's going to talk about mostly their parents. It's always easy to criticize your parents. He's going to talk about two episodes he's going to talk about. He's going to talk about the story of the Meraglim, the spies, and what went bad there, which caused the 40-year delay in the desert, and then next week we're going to talk about the golden calf, the two big episodes that really ruined the Jewish people.
Learn from our mistakes, is that what he said?
Yes, he's focusing the story, he's recasting the story to figure out where was the mistakes and why they had the mistake and what was their weakness and why it happened to them. And what happened to, more principally, to their parents, and how them as the children should not follow in the same footsteps. Typically, it's a good thing when a child follows in the footsteps of the parents, but not their mistakes. And it's very hard to see the weaknesses and lacks of our parents, especially if we have absorbed those same traits. So in a certain sense, Moshe has a very difficult job. He's talking about the parents and them as one. And he's going to tell a number of stories where they fell short. And he's going to bring an insight to them. And with that, they'll be able to be, that's a real inheritance. That's a real value. Because this way they will not fall into the same traps of their fathers. And therefore, when they go into the land, they will be successful. They will not sabotage themselves. They will not fall down the same way as their fathers. That was Moshe's hope, his aspiration. That's why he did this, okay? And we read this because it's important, because those problems vex the Jewish people eternally. That's the same reason why we have the Haftarot of the 3 weeks deal with systemic societal problems that challenge Jewish people, that we partake of those same problems as well. So we don't do it every week. We do it 3 weeks a year. Not too much. Okay? A little bit. In other words, there's a verse that said, the rabbis say in the Talmud that when you're dealing with education and working with kids and with friends and with colleagues, you have to makara b'yamin, you have to bring them close with your right hand, and marachik b'smol, and push them away with your left hand. Which means that there has to be a careful balance in so far as warm love and tough love. You know what I'm saying? You have to do it in a very thoughtful, careful way if you want to help real growth. I want to get to, it, this is a takeaway for all of us, and myself included. The habit of success is going from an avoider of constructive criticism, which Suzanne pointed out is the norm, to a seeker of constructive criticism. Proverbs says as follows, Musar Hashem b'ni al tamas, the discipline or the rebuke of God, my son, do not degrade, do not reject. V'al takot betochachto, do not abhor his rebuke. So, let me give you an example. Let me start with a simple example. Let's say you want to get into shape. Let's say, you know, Corona's here. It's an opportunity. I work from home. I don't have a commute. You know, I want to use this opportunity to get really into good shape. In order to do that, I know I don't have the self discipline to do this myself. I'm going to hire a personal trainer. Okay? And the personal trainer comes to my house. And he wants to give me an assessment. He says, all right, Penny, get down. I want you to see, do 25 push-ups. And then I'm doing my push-ups. He says, you know, Penny, your tush is the way up there. You got to look straight, and you're looking down, and your form, we got to work on this. So I have two choices right there. I can either say, what are you talking about? These are awesome push-ups. These push-ups are fantastic. And I can get angry at the personal trainer and ignore him. What does he know? I know a push-up. This is a good push-up. But or I could say, look, I'm not an athlete. This is his area of expertise. If I listen to his criticism, constructive criticism, I'm going to be improved. He's going to help me out with my form. He's going to make sure that I don't get injured myself. He's going to make sure I do things effectively, efficiently. So I should, if I listen to him, even though it's painful, sometimes a personal trainer can say mean things, okay? You know, they can criticize, you know, whatever, did you work out, whatever, blah, 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 your form, your this form, you know. In fact, on TV, we've all seen as a source of entertainment, like on those the America's Greatest Loser, they'll always get the Julian Michaels, who just rip into the people who are trying to get into shape. It's like, you know, it's very nice. We love to see other people getting criticized. We don't, but when it comes to ourselves, that we don't like so much. So really, the takeaway is that in life, what Mishle says, what the whole book of Devarim says, what MLK is saying, if you can endure the subtle psychological pain of enduring being criticized and know the person's trying to help you out and is not criticizing your character but criticizing your behaviors and where you can work on, you will be successful. It applies in relationships. It applies in business. It applies in sports and health and well-being. It applies in learning. It applies growth as a Jew. In every area, you want to be a person who can be a seeker of constructive criticism. You want to be that person who can ask your friend, say, is there anything on my midot, on my personal character traits that you think I need to work on? And I want you to tell it to me, and I know it's going to hurt, but I'm going to grin and I'm going to bear it. Just let me know. Not so much, just a little bit, okay? And if you can do that, if you can get people to be honest with you, you can be tremendously improved. Most people, you see that how Moshe and MLK and all the others have to use tremendous skills to get people to hear something. If you can be a person who is, like as Mishle says, a person who seeks constructive criticism, you're on the job, says, you go to your supervisor and says, I'm doing this job. I'm looking to do this better. Would you be honest with me and ask me and tell me how I could do this better? If you go to your friend and say, you know, I know I'm not perfect. Is there a
quality, a midah, a character trait that you that I can improve upon. Not too much. If you can do that, you will experience a breakthrough. And that's really the thing too. And there's two. And that is, are you a, the goal is, are you a avoider of constructive criticism, or are you a seeker of constructive criticism? And what MLK did, and what Moshe was doing, was using a tremendous amount of psychological insight, tremendous amount of oratory skills, tremendous amount of drama and theatrics to be able to get America and the Jewish people to hear something. It is not easy. That's what really therapy is. A therapist, it's easy, you know, might know what the problem that the person is struggling with, but they know they can't say it in the first day. They have to say it in a way that a person, it's not about saying it. Can a person hear it? You want to be a person who is seeking constructive criticism. If you can get that skill, 5%, 10%, 15%, your life will be dramatically improved. And that really is a takeaway. We're starting the 9 days. It's a time for the Jewish people to look inward as both as individuals and a community. And we all got stuff. Nobody doesn't have stuff. We got stuff. I have stuff. You have stuff. We all have stuff. And to be able to be open to constructive criticism is really and honesty is the beginning of real growth, personal growth. Without that, if you want to keep the illusion about everything is fine, there'll be no growth. And you can live to 1,000 years old and the person will be the same. And that really is, I think, the message of MLK. I think that's the message of the Book of Devarim. I think that's the message of the 3 weeks. And that's what I wanted to share with you tonight. Questions?
Before questions, I just want to add, I noticed that this is also something for relationships between, especially for dating, for me, myself. I messed up royally by trying to help somebody recently, like when I could just listen and shut my mouth and smile, and maybe like a week later, offer my feedback instead of solving her problem.
Right. Well, that's a sort of a universal male-female challenge. Sometimes a woman wants to share a problem. They're not looking you to solve the problem. They're looking you to empathize and be emotionally sensitive to the problem. Yes, that is a classic male problem. I have made that mistake on countless occasions. Guilty as charged. That's true. But that brings to the point of that is a, you have to ask yourself a question, is a person open to constructive criticism?
Right. That's where it came in, right? Is that person open? Even if it wasn't criticism, it was just like coming came
from. Are they open about any, hearing at whatever thing you, in other words, correct.
It becomes critical and criticizing regardless in that scenario.
Correct. Yeah, this is sort of a bonus track. A wise person only says something that will be heard. That's the definition of a chacham. A wise person only says something that can be heard. Not that you can say a lot of things. Only that will be heard by the individual. And that takes a lot of self-restraint because we want to say a lot of stuff. We have comments. I don't know about you, Jews. Jews have comments, okay? So most of those are not helpful if the person won't hear them. So good point. All right, questions? All right, we're good. All right, guys, have a great night, and I'll see you next week.
Thank you so much. Well, thank you. Bye, everybody.
All the best. Bye.